Case number 213673, Business Development Corporation of South Carolina versus Rudder and Russin LLC et al. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Carridge, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good morning.
Morning. May it please the court, my name is Paul Carriage, and I represent Business Development Corporation of South Carolina, also known as BDC. I've asked to save 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if that's okay.
All right.
This case is about Ohio's res judicata doctrine. If this court finds the district court erred on any single element when applying that doctrine, this court should reverse this case and remand it to the district court. Now, BDC thinks we can win on any of the four arguments, but I'd like to briefly address the two that are perhaps the simplest or the straightest line to reversal. And the first of those is the same transaction or common nucleus of operative facts element. So what this basically means is, are the sets of claims in the first case and the sets of the claims in the second case sufficiently close, or is there daylight in between them? Now, that sort of begs some questions that the Ohio Supreme Court has answered, and because this is a diversity case, the Ohio Supreme Court is going to control. And so, for example, in Davis versus Walmart, the court addressed there was a workplace incident in a first case where an individual was killed in a traffic accident. He was a forklift driver and a truck hit him, and the spouse raised some wrongful death claims, some of which settled and some of which were decided at trial. And then post-trial, the spouse plaintiff discovered some spoliation of evidence and brought a separate claim for spoliation of evidence. The trial court in that case dismissed on summary judgment. The appellate court reversed, and then the case went up to the Ohio Supreme Court. And what the Ohio Supreme Court said was that a reasonable minds could disagree whether acts that occurred during the course of a case arose from the same common nucleus of operative facts as those that arose prior to the case, those that led to the underlying.
What do you, so I guess the way I would distinguish Davis is in that case, the judgment winner was pursuing claims that were not inconsistent with the judgment. In this case, you're essentially bringing a collateral attack on the judgment, because if your claim is allowed to proceed, it would upend the state court's judgment in favor of the Suggs. There was a finite sum of money. The finite sum of money was going to be distributed between the Suggs and their mortgagees or mortgagors, I forget which was which. The court concluded that the sum of money should be divided this way, and you're seeking to say that judgment is bad because we should have gotten the money and not the Suggs. And so that's completely different from Davis, where it was just an additional claim for damages that would in no way undermine the judgment.
So a couple of points on that. First, I think that's a little bit too narrow of a way to view the settlement in this case. The settlement wouldn't have happened had BDC not been excluded from the process, because BDC would have said, well, we need $200,000, and then we need to work out. So it's not that there is a finite amount of money. There was a bad faith claim in this case that could significantly up the amount of damages. So I don't think it's a fair representation to say, I think it was 300 and something thousand, might be about 380 or something. I don't think it's fair to say that that was a finite amount of money. Secondly,
it was clear that BDC had a significant interest in the case, and they show up and they say they're a nominal party. I don't understand the litigation tactics of your client. I know you weren't counsel at the time, but it just doesn't make any sense to me. They weren't a nominal party. They clearly either had a claim that they wanted to assert or they didn't, and you didn't. And now you're showing up after the fact.
So as an initial matter, I think that doesn't relate to whether this is the same operative facts. But nonetheless, if we were talking at a CLE about best practices, I think we could say a lot of things about what BDC did here and say it should be different. But I'm not sure that really has any legal effect, because what we had here was a complaint. And the state court complaint said BDC is listed on the policy, BDC is entitled to payment, and BDC has an interest in the proceeds. of the litigation. The failure to answer is an admission to those facts. So BDC admitted, yeah, we're listed in the policy as a mortgagee, yeah, we're entitled to payment, and yeah, we have an interest in these policy proceeds. So I understand that best practice would definitely have been to enter an appearance. I don't doubt that for one second. But that's a little different from saying, well, when you don't enter an appearance where you admit the allegations in the complaint, which is what failing to answer does, then the other side of the V gets to just change those allegations. That's not permitted under the rules, I think it's 5A and 54C. If you change the allegations in a complaint by any method, they have to serve BDC. And under 54, if you're asking, which this essentially was like a default judgment motion, this motion to enforce settlement. If you pursue that avenue of attack on a party, you can only ask for the default judgment that is requested in the complaint. And that's not what happened here. So then BDC...
Wait a minute now. Your client knew or should have known that the proceeds were being litigated about in that lawsuit. And if they had an interest in those proceeds, regardless of what your client thought about the sufficiency of the allegations, and your client wanted to protect his interests, it would have been involved. It would have gotten involved in that litigation, and certainly had the opportunity to do so. You didn't do so, and now after the fact, you're trying to pursue the matter all over again. If you had the opportunity to get involved and to protect your client did and to protect his interests and failed to do so, you're pretty much out of luck, don't you think?
So with respect, Judge Clay, I'm going to have to disagree with you on the chose not to get involved. That wasn't the process that happened here, because we have these fraud allegations that pass muster under the plausibility standard.
Your argument is that your client didn't get notice from someone about the litigation, and there was a legal duty of this fellow to advise about the pendency or the progress of the litigation, and that's what's now giving rise to the rights you're now attempting to assert.
That's the fraud claim. That representation that we will keep you informed. So the duty to monitor.
Well, what's the other claim?
There's abusive process, which under Yalkovich, the Ohio Supreme Court said, abusive process during a litigation cannot arise out of the same operative facts as the underlying litigation. So even if this court was to say, well, the fraud claim was the same operative facts, which really would run contrary to Davis, and I know you disagree with me on that point, but there would still be other claims, like abusive process can't arise out of facts that happen. Abusive process necessarily arise out of facts that happen.
Well, what are the facts here that give rise to an abusive process claim?
The change of allegation of BDC has an interest, and then there's a change to BDC doesn't have an interest, and then the failure to serve per 5A and 54C. That would be one. The second would be...
Why does that constitute abusive process? I'm not following you.
So I'm sorry, let me finish my thought, and I think I'll answer your question, please. The second part of that equation is the BDC was actually being served by everyone right up until the motion to enforce settlement was filed. Everyone was serving BDC, regardless of the fact that BDC hadn't entered an appearance and hadn't answered. And then the motion to enforce settlement was filed on paper the day of, and was not served on BDC. And State Farm's response to that also not served on BDC. And this just goes to that sort of stinks of an agreement to cut BDC out, despite this sort of acknowledgement by serving that BDC should have been involved. So I think there's a lot going on factually with the duty of this attorney to keep BDC informed. Once there's an allegation that there's a representation, I'll keep you informed. There's case law on this out of Ohio, the Burris case, where I think it was the Tenth Circuit, said once an attorney makes a representation to another attorney within that professional role.
Do you have a real good case showing this happened in some other situation, that it's a very unusual factual statement?
Burris.
You don't have any, or you do have
any? Yeah, but it's Burris versus State Farm. It was the 10th Circuit. It's 2009, Ohio 5123. And in that case, the court was dealing with a promissory estoppel allegation, and that is a reasonable reliance issue. And the court said, because the attorney has an obligation not to get involved in misrepresentations or fraud, it is per se reasonable to rely on that attorney's representation.
Are you basing your case on the opposing attorney's failure to notify you, or the court's failure to notify you?
The opposing attorney's failure. That's what the fraud claim is. And that's why I just want to circle back before my time runs out here, that's a fraud allegation on the merits, but what we're dealing with at this stage of the proceedings, on the pleadings, is the res judicata issue, and there's four elements. So even if you don't believe a word I said on my fraud arguments, there's still three other reasons to reverse, and I think I'm probably going to run out of time here. So
one quick question on jurisdiction. We have a sua sponte duty to raise potential jurisdictional defects, and
sure.
The complaint didn't. The complaint treated the law firms as corporations and suggested their principal place of business, but they're LLCs and LLPs, which take the citizenship of their members. Do you know that the law firms, the members of the law firms, are all diverse from your client? I assume they're all Ohio, but I just thought if we got oral confirmation, that would satisfy.
I do not know that. My understanding is that none of them are South Carolina residents, based on the fact that they didn't raise that argument, not based on something I've heard or know. So I think that's all I can say on that matter.
All right.
I'll pipe down and see you on rebuttal.
Thank you. Morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Holly Marie Wilson. I'm here on behalf of the defendant appellees Rutter Russin, Robert Rutter, Justin Rudin, and I'm arguing in favor of the district court's dismissal below.
Please turn the light on over there for the podium.
I have 5 minutes. It's a limited amount of time. I'm going to jump in just to very few points, and then I'll defer to co-counsel who have their own arguments. The first has to do with policy proceeds paid. What exactly were the allegations in the SUG lawsuit with respect to BDC? And that was clear. They were entitled, or according to the complaint, four different mortgagees each have an interest in the policy proceeds paid in this case and may have their own independent claims for policy benefits. There were no policy proceeds paid in this case. This was the resolution of bad faith litigation. It was a compromise settlement. State Farm never conceded coverage. So there are no policy proceeds paid. That's all BDC has an entitlement to, policy proceeds paid. If we look at the State Farm policy, it's even more specific. Mortgagees are entitled to any loss payable under coverage A. Settlement isn't under coverage A. Number two, so there's no change in claims here. The SUGs allege that BDC may have an interest in policy proceeds and may have their own independent claims. BDC never pursued any of these independent claims.
Why? So what would you do with Davis? Why? Davis does seem to suggest that conduct during litigation is separate from conduct before the litigation starts, Davis versus Walmart. So why wouldn't that rule apply here?
It doesn't apply here because you'd have to collaterally challenge this judgment. Even if there was some ability to say, okay, we need to go back, BDC does not recover unless there is a collateral attack on this state court judgment and another district court says, I think Judge McDonald got it wrong. There is an entitlement to policy proceeds, and here's why.
Is there a law for the idea? The idea is intuitive to me, but is there a law for the idea that conduct during the, or challenging to conduct during the litigation that would essentially upset the judgment should be treated as the same transaction for res judicata purposes, whereas conduct during the litigation that would not, should not be treated as the same transaction? Because I agree with your point that it does seem problematic to upset a judgment, but what does that have to do with whether it's the same transaction?
I think that because it is one of those intuitive understandings, I'm not aware of a case directly on point which would stand for that proposition. And again, I think it's intuitive. Number two, this idea that there was a promise or some fraudulent conduct on behalf of the law firm which encouraged BDC to abandon its rights. We have the correspondence between BDC's attorney and Justin Rudin in the record, and it's clear. What the attorney for BDC says is, my clients reviewed the lawsuit, they consider themselves a nominal party, they are not going to participate in the litigation. If you have any questions or you need anything, give me a call. There's no promise there. There's no reliance. There's no an opposing counsel saying, you know what, don't worry. Don't answer the complaint. You don't have to do a thing. I'm going to protect your interests. That's not what happened in this case. That's not what the evidence in the record says happened in this case.
Well, if Business Development Corporation had entered into the case, there wouldn't be a problem here, right?
None whatsoever. They could have challenged the settlement. I don't know that there's much they could have done. They weren't the policy holder, but they could have challenged the settlement. They could have stepped in and said, hey, Judge McDonald, we get a piece of this. Even though the policy doesn't afford us a piece of this, we still get a piece. And more importantly, if there was some type of fraud that occurred here, there's a remedy for that under Ohio law, and that's 60B. BDC says, well, we didn't know about the resolution until a year or so after Judge McDonald's decision. But what we do know from the state court docket is that in November of 2015, when Judge McDonald made her decision, that decision was sent to BDC by the Cuyahoga County Clerk of Courts, pursuant to Rule 58, Ohio Civil Rule 58. So BDC gets notice of the judgment at the time it's rendered. It doesn't do anything for a year.
Can I ask before your time ends, can you assert that your client is, in fact, the members of your law firm are all Ohio citizens?
At the time the lawsuit was filed and at the time of the conduct, yes, they were all residents of Ohio. Thank you for your time today, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Richard Witkowski, and I represent Gallagher Gams and attorney Mark Gams. Given the default by the BDC in regards to responding to the complaint and participating in the litigation, my clients, at the point where there was a motion by the plaintiffs for a settlement, for approval of the settlement, my clients specifically filed a motion for clarification from the court, asking for direction from the court as to who would receive payment under the settlement. We were given very specific instructions as to how to proceed, and it did not include a payment to BDC. My clients complied with the order of the court and issued the settlement checks in accordance with that. They have no viable claims against my clients. My clients had no duty to them. My clients proceeded in an appropriate way. And the remedy, if they wanted to pursue a disruption of the settlement or an objection to the settlement, was the 60B. They had time to do it, and they failed to do it. But my clients had no culpability, no intentional misconduct, no fraud, no abuse of process, no tortious interference, as were alleged to have done. My clients were the attorneys for State Farm and cannot be responsible for a tortious interference when under agency principle.
Was a copy of that notice sent out to counsel for the plaintiff here, BDC?
The notice of the judgment?
the notice that when you wanted direction from the court as to how to distribute this?
No, it was not, Your Honor.
And why not, just as a pragmatic matter?
At that point, Your Honor, I'm not sure there was a decision made to exclude BDC or not, but they were not served by any of the parties. I think the understanding was that at the point in time where the settlement was being negotiated was that they had defaulted and were not entitled.
What about the allegations that they were served with kind of irrelevant papers all the way up to the key moment where their interest was going to be distinguished, and then surprise, surprise, they weren't served with those? Do you think that suggests any type of fraud?
Well, Your Honor, I think the judge pointed out that the conduct of the parties made sense in terms of what was available for distribution. And because they were a defaulting party and were owed no obligations under the civil rules to be notified, we never made any obligation or representation that we would do so, and we were complying with the court's instructions. The court did notify them, and they failed to do anything about it timely. They were notified, I think the judgment was filed in February of 16. They became aware of it in, I believe, December of 16, and had 3 or 4 months to file their motion under 60B, had they chose to do so. They failed to do that, and then failed to do anything for an additional 3 years. It was almost 4 years after where they finally made a move and filed the complaint, but the tortious interference and abuse of process claims are essentially barred by the 4-year statute of limitations.
You admit they should have gotten service of a copy of that judgment, right?
Well, they did get a copy.
They did get it, okay. And you didn't hear anything more from them?
There was no contact until almost 4 years later. If you have any more questions, I'll be...
Can you confirm, too, that your client, the law firm, is their members are Ohio?
Yes, they are, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Jason Goldschmidt, and I'm here on behalf of State Farm Fire and Casualty Company. Your Honors, we request that you also affirm the district court's order granting the motion for judgment on the pleadings on behalf of State Farm, because the district court correctly found that these claims are barred by res judicata. There are also alternative bases upon which this court can affirm the decision on behalf of State Farm, primarily that BDC failed to comply with the State Farm policy's 1-year suit limitation clause, and BDC's bad faith claim against State Farm necessarily fails as a matter of law, as all State Farm did was merely comply with a valid state court order. There's no dispute that BDC was served with a complaint in this matter. State Farm, after a dispute arose as to the settlement of the underlying lawsuit, a motion to enforce was filed. State Farm specifically opposed that motion. State Farm advised the court that it was constrained by the policy language to include BDC as a mortgagee. The state court simply ordered otherwise. The state court found that BDC has no right to the settlement proceeds, and that State Farm was within its rights to exclude BDC from any settlement.
And why was that? Because it didn't make an appearance at the right time?
Well, there were a few different reasons for the Rudder defendant's motion, and it was because they had failed to comply with the 1-year suit limitation clause and had failed to appear in the underlying lawsuit. Which also goes to the reason why this is the same transaction and occurrence, to your question, Judge Murphy, is that the same arguments would be made here, which was that BDC's failure to comply with the State Farm's 1-year suit limitation clause, which was the same reason, presumably, that the state court found that BDC did not have an interest in the settlement proceeds here. The state court also specifically ordered the manner in which this settlement payment is to be made, excluding BDC. Thus, this lawsuit is nothing more than a collateral attack on that state court judgment that BDC did not deign to enter an appearance and protect itself. Notably, BDC does not assert any fraud or collusion claims against State Farm in this matter, only abuse of process, breach of contract, and bad faith. Therefore, any discussion of fraud simply does not apply to State Farm. As to the failure of service, BDC was not entitled to service of any motion to enforce. It was in default at that time, and the only exception to that rule under Ohio Civil Rule 7A applies to pleadings, and clearly a motion to enforce is not a pleading.
If BDC had made an appearance in the case through counsel when it was filed, then they would have got their money, or is there something else wrong with their position?
Well,
probably would have, right?
Unclear, Your Honor. At the time, it certainly could have been argued that BDC still had not complied with and had not timely filed a claim against State Farm with respect to the one-year suit limitation clause, which the policy specifically says applies to mortgagees. Okay. So
that's even before the case was filed? You're talking about they should have claimed this money?
That was this loss was in February of 2014. And this all occurred in November of 2015, which is why it was one of the reasons why the Rutter defendants filed the motion to enforce, one of the bases of which was BDC's failure to comply.
Do mortgagees have a right to enforce the insurance provisions if the client doesn't want to or the mortgager doesn't want to?
At least the suits against us and the mortgagee, they specifically say that these provisions apply as to mortgagees.
So they could bring suit under the contract, the insurance contract?
Correct.
What do you do with the, res judicata or claim preclusion is usually thought of as the plaintiff brings a claim, there's a judgment, and the plaintiff tries to bring another claim. This is a little different because technically BDC was a defendant asserting a claim, and it's almost like defense preclusion or something. This is an odd case, as Judge Seiler said. Do you think that claim preclusion applies the same way when it's essentially what is a counterclaim?
I do believe that it does, Your Honor. I agree this is a bit of a unique scenario, but the fact of the matter is BDC's interests were clearly alleged in the underlying lawsuit. As you mentioned, they were named as a defendant. Their interest was clearly at stake in the underlying lawsuit. They could have entered an appearance, they should have entered an appearance and protected that interest. The fact that they chose not to should not eliminate the preclusive effect of res judicata, as it would simply require this court, as mentioned, to undo the state court's judgment, which this court should not be willing to do at this point in time. And I believe my time is up, Your Honor, so I thank you for your time and request that you affirm the district court's order.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Thank you. I'd like to just clear up.
Counsel, you never did answer the question I asked you during your initial presentation as to what facts constituted this abuse of process allegation. I asked you the question and you started talking about something else, but you never answered the question.
So,
do you have an answer or no?
Absolutely. The failure to serve upon changing the allegation.
What's that?
The failure to serve BDC after changing the allegations from BDC has an interest to BDC has no interest was designed to preclude BDC from collecting. That's an abusive process. Those are the facts that we're alleging. Now, bear in mind, we're not, at least it's very much side issues that we're talking about the merits of the claims. We're really here to talk, at least in the first instance, about res judicata. And there's allegations of abusive process, there's allegations of fraud, they're all plausible within the complaint. But I do want to clear up a couple of things in the record. Firstly, the representation, BDC alleged the representation for I Will Keep You Informed by telephone. And there's no transcript of a telephone call in the record. So the idea that the all of the representations are in the record is not true.
Well, I'm not sure what you said there constitutes the elements of abuse of process, but if that's all you have to say about it, go ahead with the rest of your argument.
Sure. Second up, there's an affidavit in the complaint. It's at 36-4. Page ID 523, paragraph 11, where the person that receives legal mail for BDC says he never got notice until December 21st, 2016. So this notion that it's undisputed that BDC received notice earlier than that date is belied by the record. And again, we're on the pleadings, so the record needs to be read in the way that most favors BDC. With regard to the policy proceeds, I think there's two issues there. There was an argument that, well, this is a claim that's not based on resolution of a loss claim, so BDC has no interest, and there's a one-year limit. And I think there's a couple of issues with the contract, which I think are laid out in the brief. I'm not sure I can add anything to that. But I do think that the waiver argument needs a little bit more discussion, so let me talk about that. MidFirst Bank didn't enter an appearance. They did exactly what BDC did, and they received settlement funds. So whatever BDC did differently, there's nothing in the record to show that. And that would show either that these arguments are sort of a post hoc manufactured justification for cutting out BDC, because MidFirst Bank behaved exactly the same, just the amount of the mortgage was a lot smaller. And Bank of America entered an appearance way after the deadline that my friends on the other side are now asserting. So the idea that there's this one-year deadline, it would have been February of 2015. Well, Bank of America didn't enter an appearance until the summer of 2015. So that also looks like there's questions about whether State Farm really understood the contract to act this way, but there's also some questions there about whether they waived that one-year provision in this case. And I think those are factual disputes that need to be resolved on the merits of the claims, and not really a res judicata issue anyway. In Mansour and Hall, both cited in the brief, court said abuse of process is not out of the same common nucleus of operative facts as the underlying litigation. Those are two cases that are on point. Yalkovich was talking about mandatory counterclaims under 13A, which is a codification of res judicata. Same thing, abuse of process, not out of the same nucleus of operative facts as the underlying claim. And lastly, I'm out of time, so I'll pipe down. Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you very much. And the case is submitted. There being no further cases for argument, court may be adjourned.